The first talk today is going to be Chris Sigurdsson, who's going to tell us about neutrinos.
Well, thanks everyone for coming out here at the crack of nine. I know it's difficult. And today I'm going to try and convince you that the CMB is actually a particle physics experiment, and that I'm actually an experimental particle physicist. So we'll see how I do. So in that vein, I'm going to make some comparisons with something you might believe is a real particle physics experiment. And here it is, the LHC. It's a modern particle physics experiment. And the first thing you need to do a particle physics experiment is a great place to do it. And Geneva is a great city, great architecture, and there's nice buildings, there's fountains, then there's the LHC. And once you have a great place to set up and build your particle physics experiment, then you start colliding protons around the beam here. And of course, you collide the particles at the center, and then they go smush, smush, and a bunch of stuff flies out to the sides. So you collide particles at the center, and you see what comes out at a distance. And from that, you can learn about the properties of the particles that you smash together at the center. Now, if you just do this once, you're in trouble, because you'll just have one event, and you won't be able to learn too much from only one event. But fortunately, there's lots of protons. There's a high luminosity at the LHC. And so at the same place, say at the ATLAS experiment, you look at these collisions of the particles many times. You see many events. You get statistics on all these events. And you collect that all together and get constraints on the physics, the particle physics that you're interested in. Right? So to summarize, to do particle physics, you have to find a place to run an experiment. You have to carefully set up and run the experiment and have detectors to measure things. And then repeat the same experiment at the same place many times. And then you get constraints on physics, and you celebrate, and everything is great. That's how science works, right? Now, you notice I just pointed out the ATLAS experiment. But actually, the LHC has two independent experiments, right? So LHC has ATLAS and CMS. So this is a plot of, you know, the luminosity as a function of time. And it's remarkable that in only 5 years, you know, we've found the Higgs boson, and it's fantastic. But surely, if there was infinite funding, there would be more than two experiments at the LHC. There would be, I don't know, 7,622 or something, right? So there, you know, another way to run a particle physics experiment is to run the same scattering experiment at many places at the same time. And then you get the results faster. So if you're impatient, it's great. So that's the alternative particle physics experiment I'm going to talk about now. Okay, so the universe is a wonderful place to do particle physics. So this is the universe. You know, there's galaxies. We live in galaxies. There's beautiful nebula, special places like the galactic center. And there's our workhorse particle physics paradigm, which is the cosmic microwave background. And so this is a slightly different geometry to the experiment, since we're doing everything at the same time. So what we do is we collide particles at a distance, and we see what comes in to the center. Okay. And by doing having the same experiment repeat at all places at once in the universe, we are able to get statistics, even though we only have information from one time. So that's the key sort of duality between the conventional particle physics experiment and the cosmology. Many places at the same time, and we have to wait for things to come into us. So along the same lines, right? So we run our experiment in the universe. We collide particles at some distance and see what comes into us, and we can get constraints on physics. So in recent years, the CMB has transformed everything we know about cosmology, and of course, you know, the exciting stuff recently is the Planck results. So I'm going to go through these a little bit in more detail just to set up the specific experiment I want to talk about today. So we're going to run a place, we're going to find a place to run the experiment, and the place is going to be the early universe. The nice thing about the early universe is it's a natural source, 100% natural source of particles of all types. And so we get photons, we get electrons, protons, helium, some kind of dark matter particle. And in particular, we get a whole bunch of neutrinos. So at the time of the CMB, neutrinos make up about 10% of the entire density of the universe. And so if we run an experiment involving neutrinos, there's a good chance there's going to be an impact of these neutrinos on things we can see. So once we know how we're going to get our particles, we have a source of particles. You know, at the LHC, there's some proton source. Here we're just using neutrinos that happen to be lying around. We have to look at detectors. So at the LHC, this is a cross-section of the CMS experiment, and there's all sorts of different types of detectors designed to detect and discriminate between different particles. So they can detect photons, electrons, muons, pions, nucleons. In the case of the CMB, we have telescopes that point around and collect all the microwave photons that are coming to us from the edge of the universe, and we're only limited to photons. There's a group at Princeton called TOLMI, I believe, which is trying to actually detect the cosmic neutrino background, but it hasn't happened yet. So for the moment, we're limited to photons. And the photons are just the same way that you can't detect the Higgs boson directly. And you have to look for all the decay products. The photons are kind of the equivalent of the decay products of stuff happening in the early universe. It's the messenger particles that tell us what's happening. Now, once you have detectors, you have to set up your particles in some special initial condition. So, of course, at the LHC, it's just accelerate protons to multi-TeV energies and then smash them together and see what comes out. In the case of the CMB, we set up, so we don't only have protons in the case of the CMB, we have all sorts of particles, but we set them up in special initial conditions, adiabatic initial conditions, that are initially correlations between the over and under densities of all the particles in the universe. So We have locally in space, there's some overdensity of dark matter and photons and baryons and neutrinos. And so this is a picture shown at about 100, age of the universe of 110 years, or redshift of 82,500. Now, and if you run the movie forward, these initially correlated perturbations will separate out in real space. So this is sort of like a Green's function evolution of the perturbations in the early universe. And they evolve according to linear perturbation theory and spread out. So the dark matter will stay put for the most part. The photons and the gas will propagate out at the speed of sound. And in the standard scenario, the neutrinos will propagate out at the speed of light. So the neutrinos get the furthest in a finite amount of time. The photons and gas move at speed of light divided by square root 3, so they get a little bit less far, and the dark matter is staying put. Okay, so that's the initial conditions. We set up our experiment. So everywhere in the universe, we have the same overdensities of stuff. And then if we're doing an experiment at the LHC, we just wait 5 years until we get enough events to dig in and the statistics and find some new physics. And in the case of the CMB, we have these same initial conditions everywhere in space, and we have the initial conditions seeded as a Gaussian random field with a given power spectrum, a nearly scale invariant power spectrum, and that allows us to quantitatively make predictions for what the Gaussian random field should look like at late times. So if this is some schematic representation of a Green's function of how these adiabatic perturbations evolve in time, then we want to take that Green's function and convolve it with the random field everywhere in the universe, and that gives us these special initial conditions. But since the densities are different in each point in space, we get many repeated examples of the same experiment. So that's what we have on the right here. We're convolving our initial conditions with, or convolving our Green's function with the initial conditions of the universe. Okay, so that's the procedure we're going how we generally think of how what's happening in the CMB. And why is this CMB so powerful? Well, I think beyond the fact that you can quantify how much of each kind of substance there is in the universe. Once you've sort of calibrated that away, the CMB is a metricometer, which is quite a mouthful, but anyway. So this is the in linear general relativity about an FRW universe. You can write the components of the metric tensor like this. I'm not going to go into too much detail in all of these, but this is the scalar pieces, this contributes to vector pieces, and this contributes to tensor gravitational waves. And the point is that the CMB photons traveling through the universe experience this metric, this perturbed metric, and they depend on exactly what the scalar and vector and tensor perturbations in the universe are doing. So one example you may be familiar with is that if we have tensor waves, then the polarized, the tensors have a handedness and they imprint a special B-mode polarization on the CMB. Another example you may be familiar with is that, photons traveling from the last scattering surface will have a gravitational redshift as well as having a temperature, and that will lead to the so-called Sachs-Wolfe effect. So the physics of the CMB is sensitive to the components of the metric, and that the components I want to talk about today are the scalar potentials. So in non-relativistic Newtonian gravity, we only have one gravitational potential. But in GR, the graviton is a spin 2 field, and we have two scalar potentials. In my notation today is that psi is the potential that becomes the Newtonian potential in the non-relativistic limit, and we have another potential that describes curvature fluctuations. And so psi is the thing that shows up in the Poisson equation for Newtonian gravity. And it turns out that the difference between psi and phi, delta psi I'm going to call it, is something that is sourced by shear stresses in the universe. So this is something that can only happen when you have that's only important when you have significant shear stress. And as I'll argue in a second, this occurs whenever you have particles moving relativistically, like neutrinos or photons. So Einstein's equations, of course, are relating geometry to matter and energy and stresses. And so these are the 0, 0, and I, and IJ components of Einstein equations. And the first term is just this Poisson-like equation. So this is in Fourier space. It's relating the the gradient squared of some potential to some density. And just as I said, the gradient squared of this difference between the potentials is what's sourced by the shear stresses of whatever is in the universe. Okay, so the right-hand side is the sum over all the possible species of things in the universe, including, in particular, neutrinos. And so we can use the CMB as a shearometer. And so if you have a difference in the potentials, if you don't have a difference in the potentials, then the shear will be zero. And if you do have a difference in the potentials, you have some non-zero shear. And that's the default case. So if you have standard model neutrinos, they're going to be free streaming and induce some amount of shear in the universe. So that's the setup. And now I want to go into the details of the experiment that I'm going to talk about. And that's low energy neutrino scattering. So this is Professor Fermi, and of course, in order to explain the interactions of the particle he invented, the neutrino, he invented this 4-fermion contact coupling between neutrinos. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, having a coupling between neutrinos. Now, of course, this scattering, this coupling is already there in the standard model. It's just G Fermi. And in the standard model value is that it's about 1.67 times 10 to the minus 11 MeV to the minus 2. So it's a very weak interaction, hence the name weak interactions. And if you take the physics of the standard model and you put it in and determine when the neutrinos decouple, you expect that these neutrinos will decouple at a temperature of about of 1.5 MeV. Okay, so this is the visibility function of neutrinos. So you may be used to thinking about the visibility function of photons. Well, the same thing happens for neutrinos. There's some point when they last scatter. And it's proportional to the number density of neutrinos, the strength of the interaction times the temperature squared, or G Fermi squared times the temperature to the fifth power. So if you only have standard model interactions, then the neutrinos are going to free stream after 1.5 MeV. And these free streaming neutrinos are going to create shear stresses that are imprinted on the CMB. So there was a nice paper by Bashinsky and Seljak in 2004 that found an approximate solution for this. And they showed that due to the shear stresses of the neutrinos, you get a suppression of the amplitude of the photon density perturbations and a phase shift in the amplitude, or a phase shift in the photon density perturbations that depends on the fraction of free streaming particles in the universe. So R nu is the ratio of the neutrino density to the sum of the photon and neutrino density, and it's about 403 if you have three standard model neutrinos and photons in the universe. So it's I'm just pointing this out to that's the standard case. You should bear in mind if you have other types of particles in the universe, dark radiation, etc., this ratio will be modified accordingly, and that gives you sensitivity to dark sector particles. Okay, so this is a paper that I wrote in 2006 where we just considered particles that were completely free streaming or completely coupled in the perfect fluid limit, and just considered the number of interacting particles and to see how the CMB changes as you change the number of interacting particles. And this technique was used by, for instance, Trott and Melchiori in 2005 to find evidence for free-streaming neutrinos or the cosmic neutrino background using a particular parameterization of the physics of neutrinos that was more phenomenological in the sense that it didn't have any specific particle physics backing it. It was just a way to parameterize deviations from the standard case. And so, yeah, well, in this limit, that's what we consider. We just imagined that it was super strongly coupled, and it was a perfect fluid. But I'll talk about exactly the model we have in this case right now. Okay, so the idea is that we can use, if we put in realistic particle physics interactions, we can use the CMB as an actual particle physics experiment. And we can look for non-standard self-interactions of these neutrinos. So this is, I want to advertise work done with my, so we have the paper was out last month. And this is work with my former grad student, Francis Yan Siracine, who's now a postdoc at Caltech. And that's the number if you want to look at this in more detail later. Okay, so the idea is we have some extra interactions of the neutrinos. I'm not going to talk about exactly what those are, other than the fact that we're going to model them as an extra piece of the contact interaction, so that the interaction strength of neutrinos with each other, not with the standard model, just with each other, not with the other particles in the standard model, just with each other, is bigger than G Fermi. And then we're going to try to put constraints on this contact interaction from the CMB. So if we have this general neutrino decoupling, what's going to happen is that, of course, with a bigger interaction strength, the cross-section for neutrino scattering is going to be bigger by the square of the interaction strength. And the opacity of neutrinos to self-scattering is going to be bigger. Now, I mentioned before that people have considered some parameterization of neutrino interactions in terms of a C squared viscosity. And what people have done before is they've assumed this number is some fixed number. So this is a number that relates the quadrupole of the neutrino distribution to the velocity and the total shear. And in our case, what happens is at early times, this ratio is such that it's exactly one, and it cancels out this term, and the C viscosity squared is zero. So that's the case of a perfectly tightly coupled fluid. But since we follow the evolution of the perturbations properly, at late times, this asymptotes to one-third. And that's, you know, what's going to actually happen if neutrinos did have extra interactions. So the key here is that we have to modify the Boltzmann hierarchy in order to follow how the perturbations evolve in the presence of these interactions. And you get extra terms, right? So this is the equation for the quadrupole of the neutrino distribution. Normally, you don't have this term. So normally, it only depends on higher, you know, the octopole and the velocity of the neutrinos. But now you get a term that depends on the quadrupole itself. If this coefficient is really big, it's just going to damp it out. And so all the higher moments get damped out by these interactions. And then at late times, when these coefficients get small enough, the neutrinos can start to free stream again. Okay, so almost forgot. So what I'm showing here is the neutrino visibility function as a function of redshift for different strengths of this effective neutrino interaction. And so as you dial it down from 10 to the minus 6 MeV to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 4, you see that the peak of the visibility function shifts to lower redshifts. Okay, so the key signature of neutrino scattering, then, is that because of the neutrino scattering, you damp shear perturbations. And so the signature is missing shear stress. If you detect missing shear stress in the CMB, then that's an indication that particles you thought were free streaming are not. So just to illustrate this further, this is an evolution of a single K mode of the neutrino shear stress as a function of the different strengths of this effective interaction. So the pink curve is lambda CDM, and the green curve is G effective is 10 to the minus 3 MeV to the minus 2. And you can see that after the mode, so a mode enters the horizon when k times the conformal time is equal to 1. Once these modes enter the horizon, if they have a stronger interaction strength, the shear stress stays zero for longer. And that's just the effect of the interaction. So if you have really big interactions, you have missing shear stress. And actually, the CMB is very sensitive to this. So even these tiny effects here are going to be the place where we can start to set limits. Okay, so I talked at the beginning about how you start off with everything at the same place with this in the same proportions or correlated proportions at least. And so this is a plot of having a Gaussian overdensity of perturbations at a single point, and then asking how do they spread out. So this is like the 3D Green's function of these perturbations. And so what I'm showing here in black is the standard neutrinos at some time, at some redshift of 5 times 10 to the 7. And in green is regular photons at a redshift of 5 times 10 to the 7. And then in blue is neutrinos with some self-interaction, some self-scattering. And as you can see, the neutrinos with self-scattering don't propagate as far. And red is the photons with self-scattering, and they basically overlap in the curve. So what's going on is that in a standard model case, the neutrinos get ahead of the photons, and they gravitationally pull them along for the ride a little bit. And that's what you're seeing here, in that you get this extra tail in the standard case compared to the case where you have interactions and the neutrinos are in the same place as the photons at any given time. So this is at a quite an early redshift. And if we let the movie evolve a little bit to, say, redshift 10 to the 5, you start to have a more subtle effect. So this is the neutrino distribution. In the blue is the self-interacting case, and the green is the standard case. And as you go to further times, it gets to be a more and more subtle effect. But because the CMB has so much constraining power, you can actually pull this out and use this to get constraints. So that's what we've done. We've taken this G-effective parameter and added it to all the standard parameters in the Planck analysis, and we've run the chains to try and get constraints. And here are the results. So when I started off this project, I expected to get some kind of constraints like this, where there's some value of G effective such that you have to live at smaller values of that coupling constant. Okay, that's because the CMB is only, you only have sensitivity up to some finite L, and as long as if you modify the CMB too much at high L's, then an experiment like ACT or SPT or Planck will see the deviation, and they have constraining power there. So this is what I expected. This is not what I expected. It turns out that the distribution is bimodal, and there is this standard lambda CDM cosmology mode that connects continuously to G Fermi. And then there is a disfavored region. And then at around G effective of 10 to the minus 2 MeV to the minus 2, there's a preferred region with a very sharp Gaussian peak that fits the CMB data very well. So sometimes when you do something, you find things that are unexpected. And this is, okay, so for WMAP data, WMAP is actually compatible with having the neutrinos be interacting all the way through, it turns out. It's because WMAP doesn't go to high enough L compared to Planck, and it's just you can get away with adjusting all the cosmological parameters to get something that's a reasonable fit in WMAP but not Planck. So Planck rules that piece out. Yeah, red line goes, it just stays zero, so it, very strong interactions are ruled out. Okay, so this is two CME power spectra, the best fit in the interacting neutrino mode and the lambda CDM mode. And they have different evolution, but because they have different initial conditions, which I'll talk about in a second, the primordial power spectrum is different. You get the same CMB. So it's some weird, well, I can sort of hand wave an explanation. But the one of the nice things about this the parameterization is if you make the standard plot of the correlations of this G effective parameter with basically all other parameters, it's orthogonal to them. And the one that it's least orthogonal to is N effective. And so this is what the contours look like in this 2D plane. And so you can see what's happening. So in the standard cosmology, you prefer NS of around 0.96. And in this interacting neutrino mode, you prefer a lower value of NS. And that's because in the interacting neutrino mode, you don't have the amplitude suppression that you normally have in the CMB. So you're allowed to pick a particular scale and adjust it and tilt the primordial power spectrum to fit the CMB. Yeah, we use the entire full Planck parameter. Yeah, I mean, you can see that even it shows up in WMAP, right? Okay, so the constraints I've shown so far have been assuming a particular prior on G effective, and that is just part of the game when you're doing cosmological parameters and Bayesian analysis. But it's mostly fine if you have a single-moded distribution. But if you have a multi-moded distribution, it gets really, blurred. So I was assuming a log prior on G effective. If you put a linear prior, that's the constraint. So, you know, a log prior really prefers small G effective, and a linear prior, this other mode is like way, way more preferred than the standard case. It's like one. Yeah. What's that? Oh yeah, it's the prior volume, but you can't. I mean, how are you going to argue that one or the other, or that square root of G effective, or that any, you know, reasonable function is. No, that's the thing. I mean, this. Yeah. This prior effectively gives you an infinite volume, a preferred region. Right. Yeah. Whereas, and even with an infinite volume, a preferred region, this bump is still there, so. I guess it depends on your point. I don't have a strong prior towards 10 to the minus 5, because as far as I know, no one has scattered neutrinos off each other, so. at least, you know, theoretically perhaps, but experimentally, it's ambiguous. Right, so yeah. Well, if you're in a specific model, if you have an idea of maybe the neutrino is coupled to an extra scalar, then you can look at the neutrino Bremsstrahlunging something. But yeah, for sure, you have to look at a specific model, and there's a constraint from the width of the Z for sure. But it's not the same as taking two neutrinos and smashing them off each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess we're into question period. But just to conclude, we can use the early universe for neutrino-neutrino scattering experiments and put constraints on empirically on the interaction strength of neutrinos. And curiously, we find this very sharp particular value of neutrino interactions that seems to be compatible with the CMB. So if you come up with a model that has these extra neutrino self-interactions, congratulations. And I'll leave it there.
What sampling technique do you use for your parameter estimation?
We had a lot of difficulty to sample both modes, because if you start off in the interacting neutrino mode, your chain will never leave the interacting neutrino mode since it's such a good fit, and vice versa. So we have to use annealing, basically. So we use a higher temperature chain, and then we import it, sample it down to the correct likelihood.
So if you go back to your 2D plot with the NS versus G effective, have you checked that if you draw a line of degeneracy along, you see where the blue bits are connected, right? Is the likelihood actually decreasing in those gaps?
It decreases by like delta chi squared of 10 or more.
Okay.
You had mentioned that you had a hand-waving explanation. This is me. That you had a hand-waving explanation of the physics. I'd be interested to hear that. And also, I imagine you have begun speculating about possible models. I'd be interested to hear that too.
Okay. The hand waving explanation of the physics, I think I hand waved through it, but maybe I was too fast or something. But in the interacting neutrino case, decoupling is happening around redshift 9000, and so the modes, the basically all the CMB modes from the first peak onward are not suppressed because you don't have free streaming. And so you can compensate for that by changing the primordial spectral index. And I guess that's the other cautionary tale, is that if somebody comes along and they decide they really like interacting neutrinos and they fit this model, then all the inflationary theory has to be adjusted. As far as particle physics, in this standard neutrino case, if you let the neutrino couple to some extra scalar that has a mass of like 50 MeV or something, then that would explain this kind of interaction strength. I don't have any specific realization of that. Something like Myron models, but it's just, you know, I don't want to get into the specifics. For this interacting neutrino case, I don't really have anything that works really well. You need a really low mass scalar that would mess up, well, it wouldn't really mess anything up, but it would be present during BBN, so you'd have to do the analysis in a different way.
Another question for Chris?
I guess we can talk about this later, but have you, a couple of things. First of all, have you looked at the, for example, the blue curve without the BAO? Because in all of those you have BAO data, but we know that there's this, you know, H-naught BAO degeneracy issue. Well, so that's one question. But also, this is obviously for your logarithmic prior, right? Because the volume in that little peak is small.
Yeah, this is with the log prior, yeah.
So, I'd like to. It would be great to see that, you know, the same as you did for the 1D case, for the 2D case, just to kind of actually get a handle for how much is left. But then also you say, I'm still a bit confused with the prior argument. Sorry, this is like three questions in one. You say that you don't have any bias in terms of the prior, but then if you don't, then the Jeffries prior is the one that encodes that ignorance. So saying that you don't have a prior on the prior would lead me to say that you should be putting a log prior on. So I would need more justification as to why the linear prior is better other than the peak gets bigger.
Okay, so yeah, sorry. I'll answer the last one first. I mean, the fact that I can take any sort of simple function of G effective and change the answer of whether it's 99% in one mode or 99% in the other mode tells me that I don't have enough information to right now to make an informed decision. So I can choose that, but I have no reason to, because G effective is a parameter that I made up. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So I can't tell the difference whether I should prefer one mode or the other. I think we're saying the same thing.
I think we're saying the same thing. It's just, you know, saying that Planck gives you this preferred value is really sexy, but if that's completely dominated by the prior, then it's saying that the data aren't there yet, which is fine, but that's, you know, I didn't get super, super excited the first time I saw that if I had thought that we were dominated by the prior. It's just this is really exciting, and so you want to make sure that the prior isn't driving you, because otherwise that just means we don't have enough information.
Very quick
okay,
comment
I forgot
on
your
that.
Other questions, I'm sorry.
Sorry, you could make a profile likelihood plot, and uh-huh. that completely takes out the prior, right? So as a function of G effective,
yeah.
you marginalize over the best likelihood over all the other parameters in your chains, and that would tell you where the where the data prefer you to be.
Yeah, so that we have done that, and it sort of looks like the posterior with the log prior. But with a slightly higher preference for the second mode, because you don't have this infinite volume down to negative infinity. Yeah.
All right. We better save additional questions for the coffee break. Let's thank Chris again. The next speaker will be Alberto.